Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
And welcome to a special edition of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. I'm David Helvarg, and my co-host today is Natasha Benjamin. We're both from Blue Frontier. And we're recording live to tape at the San Francisco Climate Week in the downtown studios of KALW, Bay Area Public Media. We have a great audience here today. It looks so smart and attractive. You put the heat in global warming. So give yourselves a round of applause. Today, the climate emergency is changing the physical nature of the ocean, its temperature, chemistry, currents, and color. So since it is SF Climate Week, we're going to talk both about global impacts of climate change as well as the impacts and solutions here in San Francisco Bay. And Natasha, maybe you can introduce our two guests.
Very excited to be here with all of you. I'd first like to introduce Rod Fujita, who I've known for a long time working on California fisheries issues and marine protected areas. And Rod is recently retired director of the Ocean Research and Development for the Environmental Defense Fund and is now working as a consultant with a number of different organizations, including the Monterey Bay Aquarium and Oceankind. And he's written a book, Heal the Ocean, which describes the nature of ocean environments and discusses current and emerging threats. And our other guest, Sejal Chokshi-Chu, she's an attorney and the executive director of San Francisco Baykeeper, where she's worked for over 20 years in the fight to stop pollution of the bay and more recently to address the real threat of sea level rise. She's also the co-founder of the Bay Area chapter of Environmental Professionals of Color. Thank you for both for being here today.
Yeah. Thanks.
So let's dive in, as it were. Rod, aside from driving weather and climate, the ocean's also having tremendous response to our fossil fuel-fired climate disruption. And maybe you could just share some of the impacts and role that the ocean plays.
As many of you will know, the ocean and the atmosphere are intimately connected. They look separate, but there's a lot of interaction. And that's why climate change has such a strong impact on the ocean. The ocean's been quietly soaking up gigatons of carbon dioxide ever since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, so it's been helping us out. It's also absorbing a lot of the heat that atmospheric pollution has been producing, and it's helping out in that way too. So it's moderating climate change, but it is reaching limits, as we can see by the mass coral bleachings that have occurred since the late 80s and now are particularly severe. And there are many other manifestations like sea level rise, changed hydrological cycles, something that people don't hear about much, but it has a profound effect on the ecosystems and on society. And in addition, there are the effects of the carbon dioxide itself. It's not all about the heat. The ocean is a carefully buffered system. pH is really, really important to a lot of organisms, particularly those who make shells, which are a lot of species in the ocean. And so that carbon dioxide, when it rises and the ocean absorbs it from the atmosphere, from the pollution we're spewing out, is enough to actually shift that chemical balance in the ocean. It's a profound thing to think that a human activity can shift the chemistry of the entire ocean, but it has, and that's causing pH to drop, and that's killing a lot of organisms all around the world.
It's like basically a third of the carbon that we're spewing out is getting absorbed by the ocean and making it harder, that shift, harder for any shell-forming creature to get the calcium carbonate out of the ocean.
Yeah, it's really a multifaceted threat. It's like a triple whammy. You've got your poor shellfish, you've rooted in place, you cannot escape. You have to deal with acidification, you have to deal with warming temperatures, which increases your respiration rate, which means you can't make as many babies. And if you're a coral, it often means even a small increase in temperature that persists for days or weeks, as we're seeing now, can cause the little symbiotic algae that help the coral survive to flee the coral host, and that beautiful relationship is then broken the coral starves, and that's why we're losing so many of these reefs around the world.
And locally, the effects are also becoming more and more visible.
Locally here in San Francisco Bay, we're seeing a lot of impacts from climate change already. A lot of people hear sea level rise and they're like, oh, that's going to happen like 100 years from now, so I don't really need to think about it. Actually, what's happening right now is sea levels are slowly rising and causing groundwater levels to rise. And this kind of aquatic table pushing up is actually starting to impact shoreline communities right now, and even as far as 3 miles inland. This is causing the groundwater aquifers to rise and causing really harmful VOCs, these aerial-borne chemicals, to start coming up through people's pipes in their homes. So it's already starting to impact us, and we don't even know because a lot of this stuff is very invisible. We're also seeing a lot of increased flooding of the shoreline areas, and in San Francisco Bay specifically, that means over 1,000 different industrial or historically toxic sites are being inundated with water. And when that happens, what do you think happens to all of those toxic chemicals that are buried in the ground there? They're not held in by the concrete cap that some government agency has authorized to put there. The water comes in under that cap and then displaces all of those toxins into the environment. And so we're seeing a lot of that displacement starting to happen right now. Another thing that we're really seeing here in the Bay Area are increased weather events. The storms are just bigger and harder and longer. They're causing a lot of flooding in our streets, even in San Francisco. I remember last year, I think, a lot of Instagram posts that were showing these huge areas of San Francisco Bay streets that were just inundated in water. And people are like, oh my gosh, what's going on? That's climate change. That's right there. And then we've got infrastructure that's being really overwhelmed by that. So we have stormwater infrastructure that's being overwhelmed. That means more pollution coming off of our streets, getting into storm drains, getting into the bay. And then the most horrific part of all of this is that our wastewater agencies are being impacted. So when you've got wastewater agencies being overwhelmed with floodwaters, that means that you've got sewage spills happening in the bay. And that is not cool. The other problem with that is an increase in the nutrients that are getting into the bay. So when wastewater agencies are overwhelmed, we have high levels of nitrogen and phosphorus. And if anybody remembers a couple of years ago, the harmful algal bloom that took over San Francisco Bay turned it all red. That is the kind of thing that we might see more and more often. Thousands and thousands of fish died because of that. And right now, actually down in LA, there's a harmful algal bloom that's causing major species to be sick and die. So we could be seeing more toxic algal blooms here in the San Francisco Bay if we let that kind of pollution continue unchecked.
I think coral gets a lot of attention, but here in our ocean backyard, we've lost 95% of our kelp forests. And this is hidden beneath the surface, and most people don't know about it. And it's another climate change story, another example. We're seeing things in the bay, we're seeing things in the ocean, and these losses of ecosystems and changes are having huge impacts not only on marine life, but communities that depend on those resources. So what are some of the things that we're doing here in San Francisco to address getting hit by all of, we got sea level rise, changes in the water conditions, algae blooms. What are we doing? Tell us what's happening here in the Bay.
Yeah, so we are trying to tackle all of those problems all at once. First and foremost, we are working on helping a just transition to cleaner fossil fuel energy. And so we are working on opposing all of the fossil fuel refinery expansion projects or the coal expansion projects. And we've actually made a lot of progress on that. So if anybody ever wants to feel hopeful about what's happening in this world about the climate issue, just look up what the communities have been really doing to fight fossil fuel expansion in the Bay Area, and you will feel a lot of hope and inspiration. But in order to deal with some of these problems, we've got the sea level rise issue and toxic sites. So one of the things we're really focused on is getting the cleanup of these toxic sites to be more comprehensive so that we're not planning new housing on toxic areas. We want to support new housing, but we don't want housing which in 50 years is going to be flooded and also leaching contaminants into people's homes. So really trying to make sure that cities are thinking ahead and planning more thoughtfully and carefully about these kinds of decisions that we're making now. We're also trying to really make sure that a lot of areas around the shoreline are converted from pavement and industrial development to greener areas. Oh. We're also working with cities to improve their stormwater infrastructure, because if they can upgrade these decades-old pipes and make them able to handle more water flow, and also think about how to properly capture stormwater and make sure that the green infrastructure in the cities is actually doing a good job filtering out the pollutants, collecting the water and putting it to good use, and also just making sure that it's more slowly entering the stormwater system, then we're going to be able to have a little bit better control over these larger storm events and what they're putting into the environment. And then finally, we're really pushing on the wastewater agencies to improve their infrastructure. We just actually won the first permit that requires a reduction in these harmful algal bloom pollutants. And that passed last summer, and now we've got to implement that. And so it's really about getting the cities, especially the city of San Francisco, which I can get into later, about just making these infrastructure upgrades.
Do you love the salty characters and ocean champions we have on The Rising Tide? So do we, and we're dedicated to bringing inspiring stories and voices that make waves. But here's the catch. We need your support to keep the tide rolling. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help keep The Rising Tide on the air and online. If you're ready and able to amplify these salty voices for the sea, dive in with a donation, big or small. Visit bluefront.org and join the movement. And now, back to the show.
And Rod, so obviously kelp's the new coral. It's being severely impacted by warming oceans. With coral, it's got to warm over 84 degrees, but if it goes over 56 degrees, kelp starts getting beat down. And so cause the sea played at the San Francisco Climate Week last night. I'm working on a book, The Forest and the Sea, Kelp Climate, the Future of the Ocean. There's 36 species of kelp. There's 12,000 species of seaweeds. They're not only a problem, they're a solution, you've been saying.
I'm very happy to jump on this positivity bandwagon after doom scrolling. Yes, let me just first say that these sort of bright spots that we've been discussing locally are amplified globally, right? So that gives us cause for optimism and hope. There are thousands of examples of communities all around the world, in developed countries and in developing countries, where people have taken very positive steps to address both ends of the climate equation. Mitigation, which is reducing greenhouse gas emissions. For example, New York and Vermont just passed climate Superfund bills. California's Senate and Assembly just passed a similar bill out of the Senate and Assembly committees. So these bills are on their way, and they will hold oil companies accountable for the huge amount of damage that they've caused, and take some of the burden off of taxpayers and insurance companies to pay for the effects of burning all this fossil fuel. So we could go on and on about the positive stories all around the world. That's why I wrote my book, is to try to compile that as an antidote to all the...
Without getting too far into the weeds, tell us about seaweed.
Yeah. I was hoping you'd ask me that. So at the beginning of my career, I was a seaweed biologist. I did a lot of experiments to see if we could use seaweed to treat waste, to remove nitrogen and phosphorus from water so it doesn't cause harmful algal blooms, to use it as a renewable energy source because it doesn't have any wood and cellulose, so it makes a really nice feedstock to make biogas and even jet fuel because it's very energy dense. And it turns out that 40 years later, seaweed is having somewhat of a renaissance. I think it's safe to say that because of films like Natasha's and many, many other efforts, people are really recognizing the many benefits that seaweeds can confer to both nature and people. So on the nature side, there's a lot of progress around the world to use seaweeds specifically to remove nutrients from wastewater. In Korea, for example, there's a country plan, a national plan, to increase their already huge seaweed industry and couple it with shellfish to create a nice little artificial ecosystem that can take all those waste nutrients and turn them into a resource, which is what we want to see. We want to see a circular bioeconomy, not an extractive sort of conventional capitalist paradigm. Seaweeds are also being grown to provide livelihoods for about 6 million people around the world. It's a great alternative way if you're a fisherman and you're dealing with depleted fish stocks and you live in a remote coastal community with very few economic activities. It's a nice way to earn a living and supplement your income.
Yeah, we're seeing that in Maine, where the lobster fishermen who have lost a large part of their fishery are now turning into kelp farmers.
And just to put that into a climate frame, because this is Climate Week, you may have heard that seaweeds are great at absorbing carbon, and some people conflate that with seaweed are great at sequestering carbon from the atmosphere, which is not quite true. So it's yes, seaweed absorb a great deal of carbon very rapidly. They are the most productive organisms on the planet. So that's cool. But the problem is they don't make wood, they don't make roots, they don't sequester the carbon like a tree does, or a mangrove forest does, or a seagrass meadow, or a salt marsh. So they underperform those ecosystems in terms of carbon sequestration, which means putting the carbon away for hundreds or thousands of years. But we can increase the climate mitigation potential of farmed seaweed by making stuff like cattle feed that suppresses methane emissions. In fact, that's a big play, because methane is a particularly potent greenhouse gas, which doesn't live as long in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide does. So to the extent that we can reduce methane, we are accelerating the stabilization of the climate even more.
And to defend what the kelp are doing, they only live 1 to 7 years, so they're not sequestering carbon, but they're feeding whole ecosystems. Everybody, all the kelp and the kelp runoff is all being eaten by over 1,000 species, or else the sea otters are eating what's feeding off of the kelp. So it's an incredibly abundant system. All the talk about how we can use the ocean to sequester more carbon. The ocean's absorbing 90% of our heat already, and a third of our carbon dioxide. The ocean's doing plenty for us. It's time we do something for the ocean.
Indeed, and it is disturbing to hear carbon dioxide removal, which is essential, right? We're in a situation where we not only have to dramatically decrease greenhouse emissions, we have to actually actively draw those greenhouse gas emissions down if we're ever going to meet our global commitments to climate stabilization goals. That's a fact, but I don't like the framing of the ocean as a dump site for our carbon dioxide pollution. Again, let's reframe that and think about carbon dioxide is not the problem, it's a resource potentially, and seaweed can absorb that carbon dioxide and turn it into an even more valuable resource, right? To support jobs, to support economic development, and also to enhance the climate mitigation potential of the seaweed, because seaweed produces all these great ecological benefits like biodiversity, nutrient removal. It can even reverse ocean acidification if you do it right. And it can suppress methane from cows. You can turn it into plastic and replace fossil fuel plastics. You do all kinds of great things with it. Our challenge is to manage these seaweed farms and natural seaweed beds to produce this portfolio of benefits, which we can do. We're smart enough to do that. It's going to take political will. It's going to take good governance. It's going to take the right economic incentives to do it right.
Now, I understand California's motivation for protecting the ocean, because it all goes back to the 1969 Santa Barbara oil spill. Everybody was promised that the technology was great, and 3 days after they put the first drill bit in, massive oil spill. But it's taken about 60 years since then for California to like go for offshore wind turbines, and now we're going to do deep ocean wind power. California is still reluctant to do any kind of offshore aquaculture, whether it's finfish, which is problematic, or growing seaweed. Either of you got a thought on that?
I think that there is policymaking based on science and evidence and logic, and there's policymaking based on fear. And when we're scared, we tend to use stereotypes and short-term thinking, and our prejudices kick in, right? Because we're not thinking rationally. And the government agencies are not immune from this effect. If we can flip the basis of policymaking from fear back to evidence, then we can discern which uses of the ocean are harmful and which uses are beneficial, to which uses is the ocean resilient, and to which issues and activities is the ocean resilient.
It's actually reminding me, if I could jump in, of a project that a lot of people don't know about that's happening right here in the Bay Area, and it's not a positive one, so forgive me. I'll go off my positive chant for a minute and let folks know that this kind of fear-mongering and fear-based policymaking is causing a lot of false climate solutions to really be propagated and promoted. And one thing that we're seeing right now is a proposal for a private pipeline going from the Montezuma wetlands in the North Bay all the way around the coastline of the Bay. About 45 miles of it would be underwater, and many parts of it would actually be running through communities that are really already overburdened by pollution. And this is going to be a pipeline where a lot of our local refineries can shove their carbon waste into. So they're calling it carbon sequestration, but in reality, it's a pipeline that is really dangerous, that has the potential, especially the parts underwater, to crack and leak and cause really bad damage. And in other parts of the world where these pipelines have been put into place, they actually have caused problems. And so one thing we have to really be careful of is making sure that we're not approving these projects out of fear and trying to solve the problem without a thoughtful analysis of what the real impacts are going to be.
Yeah, because a lot of oil, the oil industry is really pushing carbon sequestration technologies that don't exist, that are unproven, as an alternative to doing what we really need to do, which is a rapid transition off of fossil fuels to what the market already recognizes the future.
There's all these really innovative schemes, and many of them come right here from the Bay Area because we have a lot of smart people who care about climate change. I think the intentions are good, but now we're in full crisis mode. We have a narrowing window in which to act. We must go full throttle on emissions and drawdown at the same time. And so really the new paradigm is, for me, it's no longer offsetting or sustainability even, it's regeneration.
And California has obviously been a leader in a lot of this work. Right now at the federal level, things are quite frightening. What can we do here to try to influence some of this, what's happening at the national level? What can folks do in their day-to-day?
There's a lot of effort to dampen climate science and remove the word climate change from policies and records entirely, defunding of agencies and decimating of agencies. It's a mess right now. And really, I think the key is to not be scared of what's happening. It's to understand what's happening and understand what we can do about it. And just being with a nonprofit organization that's been on the ground for over 35 years, fighting all of this kind of government nonsense in the olden days, it makes us ready and resilient to this kind of government problematic, what do we even call this? Nonsense right now, the chaos that's happening right now. It does help us cut through a little bit of that noise and really try to focus on the actions that are happening. And so here in the Bay Area, it's understanding that there is an oil drilling project being proposed in Brentwood. There's this carbon waste dumping project being proposed all for the entire North Bay, running through a number of cities that are some of the places where we live, and we can stand up to these city councils, talk to them, tell them we don't want to see this in our neighborhoods. We don't want to see these harmful projects coming up. This is what the community in Richmond did. They were able to stop a coal expansion project there in the city of Richmond, and they were able to pass a coal ban that requires the city to stop storing and processing coal by the end of 2026. So the only coal facility in the Bay Area is going to be shut down. They're not going to be able to export coal out of the Bay Area anymore, and that's pretty incredible. So being able to understand what's going on in your community and knowing where the leverage points are, how to get involved in your local city councils, making sure that the decisions are informed, that they're not building housing on areas that are going to be flooded and inundated with toxic substances. All of these are things that we can really push for and make sure that our city councils are making decisions that we want to see. And that trickles up. And I fundamentally believe that.
And we're witnessing a movement toward autocracy. But as David says, it's a fragile movement that contains many, many unpopular aspects. And so what's the antidote to this movement? It's mobilization, it's organization. It's the only thing in history that's being able to prevent these kinds of movements toward autocracy. You've heard this before, but don't be overwhelmed by the fire hose of bad news. Find something you can focus on, something that moves you, something that uses your skill set. If you're an artist, make a creative sign to bring to the next protest so that the news cameras will focus on that. If you're a writer, write away. And if you have advocacy skills or you're good at organizing people, there are many policy vehicles moving in California right now to create and maintain our bubble, like the Climate Superfund bill that I mentioned before. But yes, let's not despair, but let's get active instead.
So we'd really like to thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. Maybe end with one of my favorite quotes from Isaac Dinesen, who says, "The cure for anything is salt water, sweat, tears, or the sea."
Nice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helvark and me, Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, Kelly Bates, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear, it's true. It's the Blue Frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.